Hey, podcast listeners, it's Anne here, and it's back. After 26 years, Twin Peaks returns for a third season on Showtime on Sunday, May 21st. And Twin Peaks, of course, is considered one of the greatest TV dramas ever made. It's got a huge cult following. Actually, so huge, it's probably not even fair to call it a cult following. Mark Frost created the show, along with film director David Lynch. And Frost is also a novelist, and his latest takes a deep dive into the history of that weird little Pacific Northwest town. The book is called The Secret History of Twin Peaks. It's structured as a kind of secret dossier that's been put together by some mysterious archivist and then annotated by an FBI agent. It includes undiscovered diary entries from Lewis and Clark, newspaper articles from the Twin Peaks Gazette, and even the menu of the Double R Diner, where pies go to die. Doug Gordon sat down with Mark Frost to find out more.
Diane, 11:30 a.m., February 24th. Entering the town of Twin Peaks, 5 miles south of the Canadian border, 12 miles west of the state line. Never seen so many trees in my life. As W.C. Fields would say, I'd rather be here than Philadelphia. 54 degrees on a slightly overcast day. Weatherman said rain. You could get paid that kind of money for being wrong 60% of the time. It'd be working. The mileage is 79,345. Gauge is on reserve. Riding on fumes here. I got to tank up when I get into town. Remind me to tell you how much that is.
Mark, for those of our listeners who aren't familiar with the original TV series Twin Peaks, can you give us a brief description of it?
Boy, brief might be tough.
Yeah, I know.
Let's see. Well, we came on the air in, I think, the spring of 1991 on ABC, which at that time was the third place network in a world that was about to rapidly change. It was really a three network world. So they had nothing to lose, and they commissioned us to do a pilot and then 7 additional episodes of this strange, what they called a nighttime soap about a small town that we set in the upper Northwest, a region that hadn't been particularly well covered in network television up to that time. And we came on the air. No one really knew what to expect. And it was like a supernova went off. I mean, we were all stunned. We got outrageous numbers of people viewing, and it suddenly became the thing that everybody needed to see. It was on Thursday nights, which allowed for a kind of water cooler culture to quickly coagulate around the show on Friday mornings. And that first 8-week span of the run of the first season, it's really kind of hard to describe how it rippled through the culture. It was a tsunami that we tried to just ride through and hang on. Then we did a second season, and at the conclusion of which, ABC decided not to move forward. So the show has lived on through cable and through DVDs, and really started to pick up steam when it was available for streaming. And weirdly, I think it's more popular today than it was perhaps at its height 26 years ago.
Yeah. And here we are talking about it 25 years later. There's going to be this new season of the show on Showtime, and you've written a novel about it. What is it about Twin Peaks that has made it such a memorable and successful television show that it has this kind of staying power?
Well, it's a very hard thing to describe. The show, I think, was able in some way to convey a kind of richness and breadth of human experience that involved the absurd, the romantic, the supernatural, the funny, the melodramatic, and the frightful, in a way that maybe no other show had up until that time done as that recipe. And it grew organically out of the process of David Lynch and I working together. And we assembled a wonderful cast of actors. We had something like 75 speaking parts that were more or less regulars on the show. And it was the first show that, in my memory, that had a completely serialized narrative from start to finish, which was also a little bit different. Now, I had come from working on a show called Hill Street Blues, where we did some of that. And Hill Street Blues was an enormously popular show in the 80s. But we never carried an arc much over three episodes at a time. And mm-hmm. and here we came on basically with this notion of filming a novel from page one. And it was just one of those lightning in a bottle kinds of things. It hit at the right time and ignited something. And here we are later and people are still talking about it. And we're bringing it back for Showtime.
Yeah. What was your working relationship with David Lynch like?
Well, it was great. We had met in, I think it was 1986. He had just finished Blue Velvet, and I was still, I think I had just come off Hill Street Blues, and I was making a movie with a director named John Schlesinger. And our agents thought we would hit it off for some reason, and we did. And we worked on a couple of projects prior to this, neither of which eventually were produced, but we really enjoyed each other's company and recognized that something kind of unique was coming out of the collaboration, which neither of us had really done up until that point. I mean, I'd written on in a writing room kind of way for television before, but I'd never sat down with a single collaborator and worked intensively, and neither had he. So it proved to be a really fruitful working relationship, and Twin Peaks was probably the fullest flower of it, and it was wonderful to kind of reignite that so many years later.
Yeah, yeah. So why did you want to write this novel, The Secret History of Twin Peaks?
Well, in a funny and almost perverse kind of way, when the show made the impact it did, I had started my life and my professional aspirations as a would-be novelist. I wrote, I think, three novels between the age of 11 and 15. I was just mad for the written word and for telling stories. I just knew instinctively that I'd been born with whatever that storytelling gene is. And so I'd always been enamored of the written word. I'd worked as a playwright. I studied as a playwright and then obviously got involved with film and television as well. But I hadn't yet gone back and exercised those novelist muscles. So after the season, the last season of the show ended, I wrote my first novel, a book called The List of Seven, mm-hmm. Which was successful enough here and internationally to keep me going in that department. And now the Secret History of Twin Peaks, the new book, is my 12th book.
Yeah,
I've written, you know, fiction, nonfiction, about sports. I've tried to turn my hand to whatever interests me.
Yeah.
And it's now become, I think, the sort of the main course of my interest in my career. And everything else is now sort of a tributary to that. So the idea of going back and exploring this town and this idea from a novelist's perspective was pretty irresistible. And I thought the time was right with the show coming back to turn my hand to that idea.
Absolutely, yeah. And much in the same way that Twin Peaks was no ordinary TV show, your novel, The Secret History of Twin Peaks, is no ordinary novel. You've written it in the form of an epistolary novel. Why did you want to take that approach?
Well, there were two reasons, really. One was with the word history in the title, it's apparent that I'm going back and I'm charting the development of this region and this town, and the kind of inherent strangeness to the culture that we capture in the show, from the moment the written word starts to exist, which to my mind was when the first clash of cultures in that area existed, when Lewis and Clark came into the area in the early part of the 19th century. So that felt like the place to start. And then as I realized moving forward, there are going to be so many voices and so many parts of the story that I want to be able to incorporate that maybe the best way to do it was through the use of found documents.
Yeah.
And then that led me to the notion of, well, what's the context for the creation of this dossier? And as you learn, as you go through it, there's a whole reason for why this particular person has assembled these documents, and what story is he attempting to tell as he pulls them together, and or he or she, we shouldn't say who that person is, and that person's commentary is what links all of the documents that he's pulled together. And then there's an added layer in that the dossier has been found at a crime scene,
yeah,
by the FBI in more or less real time, and an agent has been assigned to try to decipher what exactly the dossier is trying to tell us. So there's a second layer of storytelling in that person's footnotes as they're trying to figure out exactly who this person who identifies themselves as the archivist actually is, and what is the story that they're trying to tell. So there are mysteries woven into the concept, and I felt it all was a good organic fit for the material I was working with.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And it's a dossier of various documents, newspaper clippings, journal entries, excerpts from books, classified FBI files. And at one point, we even come across the menu of the Double R Diner.
Yeah. I thought that it was key that each of these documents have a certain veracity to them. So we worked very hard to try to recreate what the look of them might be, even so far as going back and finding fragments of journals that are in handwriting from that period that adopt the style of what government documents might have looked like during that period, all the way up through things as mundane as receipts for car sales,
yeah,
or grocery lists, or recipes. You know, it's like everything was then grist for the mill. And as a novelist, it was great fun because it allowed you to tell the story in so many voices, so that in a funny way, it kind of, I was able to hybridize my work as a novelist and my work as a dramatist, because there's a certain amount of ventriloquism that goes on.
Yeah.
As you capture each of these voices. And it was an enormous amount of fun to write.
Yeah, yeah, and it's an enormous amount of fun to read. And it seems to me that another good reason for writing it, putting the novel together this way, is it's kind of very similar to the way we read on the internet. We jump from one website to another. We bounce around from fiction to nonfiction during our internet experience. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's – I mean, I have a 13-year-old, and I, as I watch he and his friends – they're struggling with reading the written word. They've been so exposed to the avalanche of material available to them online that comes at them in so many different forms, is very often visual, and is a little bit more of a kind of disjointed funneling of information that they're grappling to make sense of than, say, my generation, which grew up, you know, reading To Kill a Mockingbird and The Lord of the Flies and Ray Bradbury and things that were traditional narrative, beautiful experiences, but the world has changed, and I sort of wanted to recreate that experience as well, as almost on an experimental basis, to see if the inclusion of visual material and the idea of drawing from all these different sources might appeal to the minds that are now attuned to this avalanche of information that's now coming at them.
Yeah, yeah, very, very well said. And this structure further develops the strong sense of place that is such a big part of the success and the staying power of Twin Peaks. And it also seems appropriate to have used this structure to me, because Twin Peaks was one of the first, if not the first, TV shows to experiment with transmedia storytelling. There was The Secret Diary of Laura Palmer, written by David Lynch's daughter Jennifer. Your brother Scott wrote the autobiography of FBI agent Dale Cooper. How much do you think this transmedia storytelling has played in the popularity of the show?
I think it had a lot to do with it, and it was sort of my hope and my plan from the beginning that we could reach an audience in a variety of different ways. I mean, we had a lot of success with soundtrack music here, and we didn't do much merchandising back then, but I'm sure people would have been very eager to have it. There was there was a desire to just simply participate in some way in this world that we had created. It really was, I guess, what we'd now routinely call world building.
Yeah.
At a very fundamental level. And the place that we created had this advantage of feeling profoundly familiar on some levels and also deeply strange.
Yeah.
So that there was an alignment of the mundane and the macabre that created a sense of I guess, reality for people that felt true to them.
Yeah.
And I can't tell you how many people I've subsequently met, and I've been on this book tour for weeks now, who really want to live in this world. You know,
mm-hmm.
the dozens of people who actually moved up to the towns that we shot the show in all those years ago and went back to shoot in last year, that it was just simply something they felt a kinship to and were drawn to in a mysterious way. So the whole thing has a very strong sense of mystery to it. And at a certain point, you just have to stand back and say, wow,
yeah,
this
is
really something.
Yeah, yeah, it definitely is. And Mark, now would probably be a great time to have you read an excerpt from The Secret History of Twin Peaks. I was thinking about the eulogy that the log lady reads at a memorial service. Does that sound okay with you?
That sounds great.
Okay, and if you could set it up, that would be great.
Well, this is a sequence, a dear friend of the log ladies and many people in town has passed away. And they've had a memorial service on the shores of Pearl Lake. And at the end of the service, Margaret stands up to speak on behalf of her friend. And the notes in the book that are jotted down by the deceased's brother are the only record we have of what Margaret said, and this is his account. Margaret holds her log and looks around, really looks, for some time before speaking. This is now. And now will never be again. Blue sky, cool air, and green, green forests, mountains, lakes, and streams. The wind, water, earth, air and fire, red, yellow, purple and white. We come from the elemental and return to it. There is change, but nothing is lost. There is much we cannot see, air, for instance, most of the time. But knowing our next breath will follow our last without fail is an act of faith, is it not? Dark times will always come as night follows day. A dark age will test us all, each and every one. Trust and do not tremble in the face of the unknown. It shall not remain unknown to you for long. Robert knows this now, as will we all in the sweet by and by.
That was great. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you. I come from a long line of hams.
Yeah, and it's working for you. And the structure of your book, I want to get past this, of course, but I mean, the structure of your book, it reminded me of Mark Danielewski's House of Leaves and the recent novel by J.J. Abrams and Doug Dorst, S. Are these novels that you're familiar with?
I haven't read them, but I've been told you're not the first person to draw my attention to them in that regard. And we actually, my editor on the book, the brilliant Colin Dickerman at Flatiron Books, knew the guys who had done the design work on JJ's book, and we hired that group to help us put together the look of this one. Because we had a very quick turnaround time.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought they did a brilliant job of executing the game plan.
Absolutely. And while I was reading, one of my favorite parts, I enjoyed all of the book, but I especially enjoyed the many excerpts from the Twin Peaks Gazette newspaper. And I couldn't help, when I was reading them, I couldn't help but think about what the artist James Rosenquist has said about newspapers. He once said that the daily newspaper is one huge, sprawling collage of juxtaposed stories that have no pre-existing relationship. The front page of the New York Times is inspiring. Does this idea of the newspaper as muse resonate with you at all?
Always. And I was fascinated by newspapers as a kid. I think I was 5 or 6 years old when I first started to take – I was living in Los Angeles at the time. I would take the front page or the front page of the sports section and retype the columns on a typewriter. I was fascinated by the mechanisms of typewriters and the idea that you could make words appear that made sense and that collectively told a story about a city really impressed me. I mean, I was part of that generation where newspapers were still considered the primary literary vehicle for carrying the news to each of its their communities. And so I got to visit the LA Times when I was on a field trip in first grade and saw the linotype machines and watched paper come off the press. And there was something truly magical about that. And I think newspapers are the lifeblood of American history. There are books that I've written, historical books, where I couldn't have even begun had I not been able to go into, say, the Boston Library and go back and peruse the 14 daily newspapers that were going in Boston when my book, The Greatest Game Ever Played, was going on in 1913. So it's a living history that's now all on microfiche in most cities and is readily available to us. And the form is still enormously appealing to me. I still love the tactile feel of a newspaper, even though it's, as we know, it's a form of communication that's rapidly falling out of our culture.
Yeah, unfortunately, and I know exactly what you mean. I too love that tactile sensation, that just the texture and the heft of reading an actual physical newspaper. It's interesting that you would write a novel that's a prequel to the Twin Peaks TV series, because correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't that the reason that you were not involved with the Twin Peaks movie Firewalk with Me? Isn't that the case, that you wanted to pick up where the TV series had left off while David Lynch was intent on making a prequel?
Well, there were two reasons. One, I was off making a movie, directing a movie, when he started making Firewalk with Me. So he did it with my blessing. But
okay.
Given that we'd been kind of cut off at the pass by ABC, my inclination was to go forward and tell the story. He more or less wanted to adapt The Secret Diary of Laura Palmer and in effect became a prequel for the series, although there are elements of it that stretch out ahead. So I was a producer on the movie, but I wasn't involved creatively in either the writing or the making of the movie. But given that, and given that it did expand the world of the town, it made sense that when I was writing the book, to try to bring all these things, including the series and the movie, into a larger context that served the history of the place and expanded the sense of the culture and the mythology that gave rise to the region and to the town specifically.
Hmm. Yeah. In the opening statement of your novel, The Archivist talks about the difference between mystery and secrets. And it seems to me that mystery and secrets are two of the major themes in both the Twin Peaks TV series and your novel. What do you think?
I would agree with that. I would say that that's one of the big game that we're hunting for here.
Yeah.
The distinction between the idea of mystery as something that is profoundly inherent in all of reality. It's a Joseph Campbell mystery.
Yeah.
As opposed to a murder mystery. It's a sense of that there's something going on just beneath the surface of what we can perceive. It's really what people talk about, I guess, when they're talking about a spiritual sense of reality, that there's something evanescent and hard to grasp and very often seems just beyond our reach, even behind a veil. But there are times in our lives when we catch glimpses of it. Often it's in times of great exaltation. It's also in times of great tragedy.
Yeah.
When the everyday cover of our mundane existence is ripped away, and we see that there's perhaps something going on that we're only tangentially aware of. It's what poetry is trying to pinpoint. It's what I guess all great art is trying to point us toward, the appreciation that there's something more than what's in front of us.
Yeah.
And that we're part of something bigger than what we appear to be. So mystery in that sense, contrasted to this idea of secrets, illustrated both in the book and in the series, and how that's more a man-made construct that's very often used by people who are trying to gather to themselves, withhold, or keep from others the accumulation of either power or wisdom or goods, which I would say is largely a destructive impulse in the human animal.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the contrast between that open, sharing, wide-eyed look at what we're actually doing here on this mysterious planet, as opposed to people who are just trying to control others. And that I hope is illustrated throughout the book pretty effectively.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think so, definitely. And this idea of the role that mystery plays in our lives serves as kind of a thematic through line in your secret history. And I know you kind of talked about it, but let me ask you, I want to ask you this anyway, from this point of view, in a more specific way, what role do you think mystery plays in our lives?
Well, what Campbell would say is that you would look to, I'll use the words mystery and mythology interchangeably here, that what mythology actually did was, if you were awake to it, awake to its presence in your life, the ways in which it would inform your existence with meaning, regardless of what you were doing. It's at the heart of Zen practice. It's at the heart of mindfulness. It's at the heart of many of the religious mysteries that have come down through the ages to us, of being alive in the moment to who you are in that moment and what you're doing. It's as simple as, you know, cutting wood and fetching water, which is the great Zen exercise.
Yeah.
Of being alert to what's around you in every single moment and not being lost in the labyrinth of our mental constructs that take us away from that immediacy. I think that's what I'm trying to get at. It's Robert Bly talked about this. Pablo Neruda talked about it. Rilke, you know, Khalil Gibran. It's the thing that we've been chasing for 2,000 years.
Yeah,
that sense of being alive in the moment. So that's, I guess, what I'm talking about when I talk about mystery.
Yeah, yeah. Now, the archivist is one of the main characters in your novel. He or she serves as our tour guide through the history of Twin Peaks, and in a sense, you are also the archivist. How big of a challenge was it for you as the creator of the archivist character and the man behind the archivist to create the narrative thread of the secret history that you present?
It was a wonderful challenge. I knew at the start that was where I wanted to go, and it was like just setting off in a canoe into uncharted waters, you know, and throwing out a net far and wide for things that I could gather and pull in and incorporate into this narrative. And a lot of it is history that we think we know, that when viewed from another angle may mean something else altogether. A lot of it is a kind of commingling that I've done of fact and fiction, which I've done before in books that I've written. And it's a technique, I guess, not unfamiliar at all to people who are aware of the genre of magical realism, which the great Latin American authors kind of introduced American culture to. But I think there's an American version of this as well. And I hope that E.L. Doctorow pioneered this, I think, that there is fodder, there is gold in reexamining our history and even pulling in the players who helped create history in what we think of as the real world to help illustrate the presence of these great themes of mystery and what's the meaning of existence, all those things that that every artist is chasing.
Hmm. That's interesting that you mentioned this American version of magical realism. But besides the archivist, the other protagonist is Douglas Milford. And this is interesting because he was a minor character on the TV series. I think he was only in two episodes, but he has a pretty big role in your novel. Can you tell me a bit about Milford and why he looms so large in The Secret History of Twin Peaks?
Well, in a funny way, to give a spine to the story once we get to the modern era, I needed a protagonist. Mm-hmm. And I needed a protagonist who had a particularly strange and serpentine path through his life to go the places that I wanted to go with the story. And Doug Milford, because we knew him so briefly and only in a very small and kind of final chapter of his life, was an open book in that regard. He was a blank slate. So he presented to me, as I thought about the characters that we already had, as the perfect vessel for taking us on this journey. And as it turned out, I think he was the right choice. It's like we can put a saddle on Doug and ride him through this entire period and get to the places that I wanted to go, and still feel plausible. I think his journey readers may find it becomes their journey as he's trying to decipher and make sense of this strange string of experiences that he's had from the 20s all the way up until, well, you'll remember from the show, his untimely death in, say, 1991.
Yeah.
Portions of the government we both serve with pride have failed us. They have lied, withheld secrets, acted in their own selfish interests at the expense of their citizens. And don't believe anyone who tells you this all began in Roswell in 47. I'm convinced now that whatever I've glimpsed or encountered and spent my life tracking has been with us since humankind came down out of the trees.
Yeah, and it seems to me that this book isn't just a secret history of Twin Peaks. In many ways, it's kind of a secret history of popular culture because Doug Milford crosses paths with Richard Nixon and the American rocket engineer Jack Parsons and even L. Ron Hubbard, who got his start as a science fiction writer but is most well-known today for founding the controversial religion Scientology. It's almost like Milford is this Leonard Zelig or Forrest Gump character. Well, why did you want to include these particular personalities?
They felt like stops on the bus line that was going to take me where I wanted to go. You know that there are these signal events and that chart a ratcheting up of this particular alternate story of American history, and they're all very strange and mysterious in their own right. So Doug Milford kind of becomes the string that we can collect these beads on to tell this story and take you through this this magical mystery tour.
Yeah, yeah. And UFOs, unidentified flying objects, also come up on more than one occasion. And Richard Nixon is very interested in them. Was he interested in them in real life?
Well, he was. And that's one of the where, you know, fact and fiction start to lean into each other. Which is the case really throughout the book. Many of these things are, if we're to trust the accounts that handed down to us, are things that actually happened. So with some slight license, you know, there's a little bit of bending toward the arc I want to tell. But in many cases, they feel like the story was already lying there. I just simply had to figure out a way to connect it.
Yeah. It's probably only fitting that you did such a deep dive in terms of history going back 200 years in time to begin the secret history of Twin Peaks, because the passage of time is one of the great themes in all of literature and drama. Well, why do you think this theme resonates so much with us?
Well, it's a universal experience. We're all trapped in time, you know. We're all aging. We're all moving toward the inevitable end of our lives, and we're all crying out for an answer. why is this happening to me?
Yeah.
You know? Why do I have to have an expiration date? You know, this is so much fun. Why do I have to leave?
Yeah.
It's a universal yearning. And the idea that I do feel that one of the great themes of any art, as you just stated, is the passage of time. And so here we have an example. We're able to go back after a 25-year gap and pick up a story. So that automatically becomes a big part of what we're working with. In 25 years, people you know will have died, people that you know will have changed irrevocably, people will have gotten happy, people would have gotten rich, people will have gotten had a tragic turn in their lives. It's inevitable. It's the story of human existence. So when you talk about how the passage of time affects us and impacts the way that we think and feel, you're talking about, I think, the fundamental dilemma of human existence.
The owls are not what they seem.
That's Mark Frost, co-creator of Twin Peaks and the author of The Secret History of Twin Peaks. He was talking with Doug Gordon. The third season of the show premieres on Showtime on May 21st, 26 years after it went off the air. I'm Anne Strainchamps. For more episodes of To the Best of Our Knowledge, check our podcast feed. You'll find us on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever else you download your favorite podcasts. To the Best of Our Knowledge is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're based in Madison, Wisconsin, and distributed by these folks.
PRI, Public Radio International.